The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Tonight marks Bill McKibben's third decade of talks at the library, which began back in 2004 with the publication of his forward-looking book, Enough: Staying Human in an Engineered Age. How to Stay Human, that is, a concern for the betterment of humanity, is also a preoccupation of his new book, The Flag, The Cross, and The Station Wagon, as he looks back at his suburban boyhood and wonders what the hell happened. The book is an attempt by a writer whose words and actions we know, trust, and respect to come to terms with the social, religious, and environmental changes of the past 50 years. McKibben is the recipient of the Gandhi Prize, the Thomas Merton Prize, and the Right Livelihood Prize. He is the Schumann Distinguished Scholar of Environmental Studies at Middlebury College, a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the founder of 350.org, and throwing a gauntlet at F. Scott Fitzgerald. His new project is Third Act, a community of experienced Americans determined to change the world for the better. Please welcome back Bill McKibben.
Look, we're at the end of, I don't know if we're at the end. We're in a hard place in our country and in our world right now. And even the last couple of weeks have seemed as grim and sad as anyone can almost remember, not just because terrible things keep happening, one shooting after another and so on, but because our system seems stuck, unable to respond, unable to figure out what to do about all that. And in a sense, I think, this book was an effort to try and figure out how we started down the path that got us stuck in some of those ways. Never had occurred to me to write a memoir because my life was as statistically normal and uneventful, especially in my youth, as it was almost possible to imagine. We moved to the American suburbs when I was 10, and that was what everybody else was doing. 80% of the growth in America, 85% in the decades after World War II, was in the suburbs. That's where everybody was going. And Lexington, Massachusetts, except for its history, where I moved, was normal in every respect, a bedroom community outside Boston, not that different from the main line of Philadelphia, wonderful schools, so on and so forth. Because it was such a, it was such the dominant form of American life, and because I think those decades were so important, it seemed to me that some of the clues probably ended up there. And so perhaps what was boring and normal was actually kind of important. Now, because it was Lexington, which like Philadelphia is the other sort of one of the other American cities with a deep history, part of the book is about American history, and in particular, the uses of that history in a country where we're discovering a lot of new things about our past and our history and how we reconcile that and what it means in relation to race and so on and so forth. I won't read you those parts. There's a long excerpt in Lit Hub, the website, yesterday that'll give you a little sense of that part. I think what I'll read is from the end, which is more about the suburban prosperity, the section that I called the station wagon in here. And in fact, I'll get to station wagons eventually, but first, just a little bit about what that world was like. What exactly is a high-end suburb? We used to call them bedroom communities, implying that they were places to rest before returning to the fray and churn of economic life. Indeed, there's very little visible productive activity in a place like Lexington. The town had actually banned light manufacturing in a referendum a few years before my family arrived. It wasn't like the shipbuilding port where my father had grown up in the Pacific Northwest. When he was a boy, the docks were busy churning out seaplane tenders and net-laying ships for the Navy in the wake of Pearl Harbor. My mother lived for a time in Pittsburgh as a girl, so she knew the flames from the furnaces and the layer of soot they deposited each day on everything around. Lexington was different, obviously, but it too had an economy. In fact, the American suburb is perhaps the greatest economic engine yet devised. An enormous percentage of America's post-war economic might, of the winnings that came from global dominance after World War II, was devoted to a single project, building bigger houses farther apart from each other. Once they were built, they had to be heated and cooled, the distances between them had to be driven, and those vast spaces had to be filled with stuff. These tasks became central to the American economy, and at its root was the most essential product, real estate itself. When we moved to Middle Street, which is where we lived, as I say, we were as middle American as it was possible to imagine, there was an empty field across the road. Idlewild Farm, as the tract was known, was a 40-acre section that had supplied a farm stand run by the Napoli family since the 1930s. The elder Napolis still lived across the street and raised extraordinary tomatoes in a small garden, but the sons had sold the land to developers the year before we arrived, moving their farm out a ring or two further in the suburbs to some town where, for the moment, acreage was less valuable. For a little while, Lexington considered the parcel as a possible home for affordable housing, until that was voted down in a referendum. After that, it was slated for a standard suburban subdivision. The first year we lived there, it was overgrown farmland, and we rode our bikes on sandy paths through the old fields, stopping when we found strawberry patches still bearing fruit. The second year we lived there, they poured the asphalt for Idlewild Drive, a bending road that ended in the classic bulbous cul-de-sac. We built a jump for our bikes on the smooth pavement. The third year, they started to build the houses, and I can remember the sight of the foundation sticking up out of the scraped and muddy soil. At night, the construction crew often left a single bouncy plank to walk if you wanted to explore, and we did. Perhaps we also harbored some early, unspoken anti-gentrification sentiment, because I remember that someone in my junior high classroom came into the possession of a BB gun, and one afternoon we took turns shooting out the newly placed windows of the half-dozen homes being built along the street. Or maybe we were just idiots. The houses, when they were finally finished, looked embarrassed, standing there without a tree in sight, save for a few saplings carefully anchored in small circles of bark mulch. Each home, I remember, came with a carriage lamp by the front door, and soon most sported a basketball hoop in the blacktop driveway. These houses weren't particularly large by current standards, a couple of thousand square feet, but they were so new they looked plopped down from space. Most of them have since been greatly enlarged, and some of them are worth now, according to the websites, $1.5 million, $1.6 million, probably more by now. We think of the suburb as a place without industry, but in fact, the suburb is itself an industry creating massive amounts of wealth through the building of homes and the escalation of property values. The total value of all the real estate in the U.S. is $33.6 trillion, or more than the GDP of China and the U.S. combined. And it was in that period, that decade, that that number took off. When my parents bought their home in 1970, they paid $30,000 for it, about $200,000 in today's money. When it sold last year, it was sold for $1 million, at which point the people who bought it immediately tore it down and built on this small footprint the largest possible house that zoning would support. It looks sort of like a combination between a junior high and a medium security prison. And that's the same all over. But that explosion happened while I was there. My first job was as a reporter for the local newspaper, and I started when I was 13 or 14. And one year I did a story about the fact that the property value, the average property value in Lexington had crossed the $100,000 barrier. And I interviewed a lot of local realtors, and they were, none of them wanted to be quoted by name, but they were all quite frank about what was going on. As one said, there used to be a lot of GI housing, but now there's nothing being built except in the super luxury class. The prosperity had become a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. Up until recently, there's been a very liberal trend here, a realtor said. But once they're in the boat and a property holder, they tend to become more conservative. Another said, those who are ultra-liberal tend to have mellowed. And another, this town has a reputation for being relatively progressive, but when push comes to shove, property values prevail. That's it in a nutshell. And I think that was it in many ways. That decade of the 1970s began not without turmoil, of course. We'd just come through the assassination of great leaders, and Watergate was just ahead, and the Vietnam War was in its cap. But there was a sense that there was strong momentum still in the direction of a more egalitarian and connected society. The women's movement had begun to do its essential work. The civil rights movement was at its apex with the passage of the Voting Rights Act. The clean air, the first Earth Day had drawn 20 million Americans into the streets, 10% of the then population, and that was enough to get the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act passed. And what do you know? The air and the water began to get cleaner. There was a sense that that was the direction in which we were headed. But that current had broken by decade's end. By later in the 1970s, the suburban tax revolt was underway with Proposition 13 in California and echoes across the country. And by 1980, Lexington, which had voted for George McGovern in 1972, cast its votes for Ronald Reagan in what was, I think, the most fateful election of my lifetime, the one that put us on that very different path. And a lot of things happened to change all that, but I'm going to describe one of them in a little detail here because I think it's pertinent to the moment. This section was called, and the title of the book called The Station Wagon, but we didn't have one. We were a sedan family. Everyone else did, though. Driveway after driveway filled with country squires and Pontiac Safaris and Buick estate wagons. The Silvermans, for instance, with whom we shared a double driveway and whom on a warm summer evening would pile all the kids in back and all the adults in front. We would drive off 2 or 3 miles to the Buttricks ice cream stand, which happened to be on the very spot where a British patrol managed to detain Paul Revere on the way from Lexington to Concord. When I say the kids piled in the back, I mean we crammed in the back cargo area. And if memory serves correctly, on the back roads, Mr. Silverman would actually lower the tailgate and let us dangle our legs over the back. Needless to say, all of this now would get you arrested for child endangerment, but we loved it without thinking about it, because the car was the absolutely unquestioned reality of our lives. Americans, of course, have been buying cars in big numbers since Henry Ford started up his assembly line in 1913, but until the end of World War II, the numbers were not that big. In 1950, there were 25 million cars registered in the country. That summer over Lexington, a fleet of 7 skyriding planes puffed out a gasoline advertisement in the sky. New blue Sunoco, it said, day after day. The message took, all such messages took. The U.S. produced 8 million new cars that year, and by the end of the decade, there were 67 million cars on the road. Those roads stretched everywhere since the 1950s also saw the construction of the interstate highway system, the largest public works program in our history. I'd never left the continent till well past college, but I'd seen an awful lot of the U.S. Vacation meant piling into the car and driving, covering ground along the route that someone in the AAA office had highlighted in our travel guide, until about 5 in the afternoon when it was time to search for a motel. You had to look in the travel guide to find the symbol for a swimming pool, and much better yet, and I hope someone else here can confirm this for me because it sounds so doubtful that young people won't believe it, but the other thing my brother and I really wanted was motels that had a technology called magic fingers, where you put a quarter in the bed and it began to shake. It seems hard to imagine that that was a highlight or attraction, but in our limited world, nothing seemed much better. It took no time, a decade, for America to construct itself around the car. That's what the suburb was, a reflection in concrete and wood and brick of the logic of the automobile, designed for its dimensions, its turning radius. We shopped at the mall one town over, and as far as I know, no one had ever approached it on foot. Why would you? More than 3/4 of Americans drove to work, and most of them drove by themselves. By 1970, Americans consumed 1/3 of the world's energy, more than the Soviet Union, Britain, West Germany, and Japan combined, and mostly because of the car. By then, there were 118 million cars and trucks on the American road, more than quadruple the number 20 years before. The cars were big, 20% bigger than they'd been just 5 years before. 3/4 of them now came with air conditioning, up from 20% in 1960, which subtracted about 2.5 miles a gallon from the fuel efficiency. Not that that was a thing anyone even thought about in 1970, because gas was 36 cents a gallon. I got my learner's permit the day I turned 15 and a half, and of course I sat through Driver's Ed with its interminable film strips about kids who took a bewildering variety of drugs and subsequently crashed their vehicles. We practiced on a driving simulator and then on a road with a baseball coach supplementing his pay. He directed me to merge onto the highway at 70 miles an hour, 4 minutes into my driving career. I loved it, and not just because cars meant sex. We literally called it parking because it meant economic freedom. You could work in order to get money to buy gas. But my work, as I've said, was for the local chain of suburban weeklies. And before long, the story that I covered more than any other was the sudden violent collision between that car culture and world geopolitics. In 1978, after the Iranian seizure of the American embassy, gas lines returned, and my job was basically, for the newspaper, making endless rounds of calls to local filling stations to see when they'd be open and for how long. The Massachusetts governor said motorists had to prove they had half a tank or less before they could pump. Local gas station owners were unenthusiastic. I don't think anyone in this business is suicidal, the owner of Steve Sunoco explained. Sticking your head in the window and looking at someone's gas gauge is suicidal. Along with the gas station owners, I also got to interview the number 3 man in the country's energy department. John Deutsch was an MIT professor, and in between Washington stints, he lived in Lexington. So I talked with him the week before his boss, President Carter, was to give a nationwide address on energy conservation. Deutsch sounded sober. If you're a person in a situation where there's too little oil, you would look for easy solutions and for scapegoats, he said. Some of this may sound a little contemporaneous. But there is no quick fix. There's no question about the fact that until the American people understand there's not as much oil as they want at prices they want, there will be problems. Carter had been striking the same note all along. In his first address as president, and listen to the words that Carter uses here, because they seem so unlike anything it's possible to imagine one of our politicians saying now. In his first address as president, he said, "We have learned that more is not necessarily better, that even our great nation has its recognized limits. The energy crisis," he said, "was a reminder that ours is the most wasteful nation on earth." As the gas lines grew longer, his sobriety deepened. "All the legislation in the world can't fix what is wrong with America," he said. "Too many of us now tend to worship self-indulgence and consumption. We should change. We should learn that owning things and consuming things does not satisfy our longing for meaning, that piling up material goods cannot fill the emptiness of lives which have no confidence or purpose. If that sounded like an attack on suburbia, well, it kind of was. Or if not an attack, then an invitation to think a little differently, and an invitation that might actually have been answered. The 1970s had begun with the publication of a book called The Limits to Growth, whose 50th anniversary is this month, I believe, an argument that we were reaching ecological boundaries, which became one of the best-selling nonfiction volumes ever. A few years later, E.F. Schumacher had produced Small is Beautiful, a book so powerful that when its German-British author came to America, Carter hosted him at the White House. The sociologist Amitai Etzioni, then a young senior policy advisor in that Carter White House, had brought the president polling data to show how up in the air America really was. The data showed that 30% of Americans were pro-growth, 31% were anti-growth, and 39% were highly uncertain. That kind of ambivalence, he told the president, was too stressful for societies to endure. And he was right, which explains, I think, that fateful 1980 election. That was the election when we decided that we were going to put solidarity behind us, the kind of world that had, the country that had come through the Depression and through the Second World War and through a period of really engaged egalitarianism afterwards, the ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country kind of world, and replace it instead with the world that Reagan envisioned, every man for himself. Government is the problem, not the solution. It was Reagan's pal, Margaret Thatcher, who said in those years, there is no such thing as society, only individual men and women. And it's that world that we've lived under ever since, I think, a world that, you know, we lived, well, pretty much right through the present day. There was a really interesting interview with Barack Obama not long ago, and he said, through Clinton, and even through how I thought about these issues when I came into office, I think there was a residual willingness to accept the political constraints that we'd inherited from the Reagan era. Probably, he said, there was an embrace of market solutions to a whole host of problems that wasn't entirely justified. Reagan's great laugh line, you'll remember, in speech after speech, was the 9 scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Ha, ha, ha. Turns out that the scariest sentences in the English language are really more like, we've run out of ventilators, or the hillside behind your house just caught on fire, which market forces are not helpful in dealing with, where you need people working together, which is what we call government, in order to let us live as we'd like to live. So that's, for my money, kind of how we got to where we are. And the question then becomes what we're going to do about it. And maybe just as much the question of who is going to do that, who's going to take the lead to do something about it. And that's what I want to talk about just for a minute here at the end. Because I think that, among other things, those of us who grew up in that era have some particular responsibilities and some particular possibilities for making change of the kind that we should make. Think about the carbon debt in generational terms. If you're 60, 82% of the world's fossil fuel emissions have occurred in your lifetime. For 85-year-olds, that number only goes up to 90%, a reminder of how compressed in time the carbon explosion has been. For 3/4 of your adult life, you've known about the dangers of the climate crisis, but it hasn't impinged much at all on your lifestyle. But now, if we're to hold the temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius, as the world promised in the Paris Climate Accords, the global lifetime carbon budget for someone born today will be 43 tons of CO2, about an eighth as much as for someone born in 1950. And even if kids do the hard work to meet that target, they will still get to live on their lives on a planet without an Arctic, where forest fire season stretches implacably on. All of these debts translate into, among other things, a reluctance to form families and have children. Or, to put it another way, generational selfishness may end up costing plenty of people the grandchildren they'd been hoping for. In November of 2020, researchers surveying people aged 26 to 45 found that 96% of them were very or extremely concerned about the well-being of their potential future children in a climate-changed world. One of the researchers said it was often heartbreaking to pour through the responses. A lot of people really poured their hearts out. There are, it seems to me, three ways to react to that heartbreak. One is to pretend that it doesn't exist, which is easy to do if you watch Fox News, the go-to network for older Americans. Its median viewer is 68 years old, which means that half of them are above that. According to Fox and its Facebook friends, you don't need to worry much about the younger generations because they're snowflakes who eat avocado toast while burning down most American cities. Another option is to take care of your own family and friends and volunteer in the community you live in to take care of some other people, all of which is fine and good, but in a way, it's what got us into this mess. It's good as far as it goes, but as far as it goes isn't good enough. The wealth gap and the carbon cap keep growing. And the third is to actually rise to the political moment and play some role in turning that clock backwards or forwards, maybe, which isn't, I think, entirely far-fetched. We've begun the work over the last year to form this new organization that we're calling Third Act, which has been catching on very quickly for organizing around democracy and climate change for people over the age of 60. And the logic of it is simple. This is a vast number of people, and there might be one or two in this room who fit in that demographic. There's 70 million of us, more than the population of France. Not only that, we all vote every single time, so we punch way above our weight politically. Not only that, fair or not, we ended up with all the money. We've got about 70% of the country's financial assets, compared with about 5% for millennials. So if we're going to pressure Wall Street or something, it's going to be pretty essential to have these folks on board. The conventional wisdom is that as you age, you become a little more conservative. And there's some statistical evidence to back that up. But we can't afford to let that be true. And I think in this case, it need not be true because there's really interesting kind of historical DNA. I mean, if you're in your 60s or 70s now, you were around for this period of really interesting political, cultural, social transformation. In the 1960s and 1970s. You were there for Earth Day, and you may have assumed that we'd made sufficient progress and kind of backed off. For whatever reason, the second act of this generation, with plenty of noble exceptions, many of whom I'm sure are here, the second act was perhaps more devoted to consumerism than to citizenship. But now, we're emerging into our third act with lots of resources, lots of skills, some time, and kids or grandkids to really focus us on what our legacy is going to be. And right now, our legacy is going to be that we're the first generations to leave the world way worse than we found it, which is not what we'd envisioned, I think, when we were younger. So that's why we're organizing to kind of do the work that we're doing, and it's great, great fun. In part, it's great fun because many of the cultural icons of that first act are still around and eager to help out. Fight me if you will, but one thing about this generation is that it produced the best music of all time. So it's really fun to be working with Carole King and Bette Midler and Patti Smith and Neil Young and all kinds of other people to kind of raise attention and get things going. It's also fun to watch people work with the young people who have taken the lead. If we're talking about climate change, it's clearly young people who are doing most of the work around the world. It's, you know, when I founded 350.org, it was with 7 college kids. The kids who took up our cry for fossil fuel divestment on college campuses, when they graduated, formed the Sunrise Movement that brought us the Green New Deal and the kind of Build Back Better bill that is its sort of offspring. And of course, around the world, there's this remarkable movement that began with Greta Thunberg, who you've all heard of, and she is great, one of my favorite people to work with in the world. But there are, as she would be the first to say, 10,000 Gretas across the planet, and they have 10 million followers. That's how many kids walked out of school in September 2019 in the biggest climate demonstrations ever. So that's great, but it does seem not okay to take the biggest problem the world ever stumbled into and assign it to 17-year-olds as their responsibility. Like, you know, between, you know, your Spanish homework and field hockey practice, would you mind also saving the planet for us? It's ignoble and it's also impractical. But it's lots of fun to work together with people. So we've been running this big campaign, just started, but it's going great guns, where we're getting people to pledge that by year's end, they'll cut up their credit cards from the big four American banks, Chase, Citi, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, unless these guys begin to slow their incredible rate of lending to the fossil fuel industry. They've lent them more than $1 trillion since the Paris Climate Accords were signed to build new pipelines and on and on and on. And it's really fun to do that in conjunction, because young people have been out in the lead, but they're very welcoming of all the help we can provide. I was just at a big demonstration outside Chase Bank in New England, where there were a whole host of high school kids kind of leading the march, and behind them a whole host of people with hairlines like mine, marching a little more slowly, but under a big banner that said "Fossils against fossil fuels," and it was a real pleasure to see that happening. Let me end there. I'm not sure we're going to win this fight, you know, the climate fight or the fight about democracy. We took things for granted that we shouldn't have taken for granted. The physical stability of the planet never occurred to us to wonder about. But those pictures from the Apollo missions that came back in our youth, the world doesn't look like that anymore. There's most of the sea ice in the Arctic is gone, melted. We didn't really ever worry about the stability of our democracy, even in the middle of Watergate. Tough as that was, we had the sense that the system was working, that it was rising to the occasion. That's not a sense we have anymore, not in a world where people storm the nation's capital and kill policemen in an effort to stop the counting of votes. So it is high time that we do what we can. And I guess this book is an effort to try and put some grounding under that, to try and help us understand how we got where we were, so maybe we can figure out how we get our way out. So I'll stop there. And Andy, if people have questions, I think there's microphones roaming around, or comments or critique or abuse or whatever comes to mind.
Thank you. Thank you for everything that you do, because there are probably, I probably speak for lots of people here, we follow you. You've been a great leader. As you were talking, I was doing the math. So I'm going to guess that the solidarity period that you spoke of was about 40 years, from roughly 1940, when everybody rolled their sleeves up, for the war effort, to Reagan, 1980. Mm-hmm. So 40 plus 1980 puts us at 2020. So we're roughly at that same point. I build homes to a standard called Passive House, which is very, 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 very efficient buildings. But no matter how efficient we build them, the fact that we have to drive everywhere negates a lot of what I do. And when I think about your description, the station wagon, 1970 to 85 or 90, I don't see how we reverse it. I was in a conference this afternoon, and I saw a graph that suggests that the expansion of suburbs is still where it's at for the real estate industry. How do we stop this momentum? It's all built around the car. And now I'm getting, I am very worried that we are going to buy into this chimera that the electric car is the answer. I think the car is the problem, electric or fossil fuel.
So first of all, many, many thanks for your work. And for people who don't know about Passive House, Google it, but Google it sometimes with the German spelling, Passivhaus, and you'll get a real sense of just how remarkable some of this construction and things can be. I'm not completely sure that I agree about electric cars. I think actually the one of the more hopeful things at the moment is that engineers have done a pretty good job over the last decade in driving down the price of renewable energy pretty dramatically, and to the point where it's the cheapest energy in the world. I wrote a piece for The New Yorker earlier this year saying we're really at the point where the 200,000-year-long human career of setting stuff on fire could more or less come to an end, that we possess the wit to rely instead now on the fact that the good Lord hung a large ball of burning gas 93 million miles away, and we know how to use it. We can capture its rays on solar panels. We can take advantage of the fact that by differentially heating the earth, it causes the winds that move those turbines, so on and so forth. And as we electrify, as we begin to produce clean electricity, we can electrify a lot of the things we do in our world. We don't need, even in old existing houses, we don't need a furnace in the basement anymore burning gas. We have air source heat pumps that are quite remarkable technology to take the heat in the ambient air outside and heat or cool your home. We have induction cooktops that can replace the open flame in your kitchen and really should, if for no other reason than it turns out that having an open flame in your kitchen is a terrible idea if you have like people with young lungs breathing the air inside and so on. And we can have electric vehicles of all kinds, e-bikes, electric buses, and probably, it strikes me for a while in the suburbs, we're going to have electric cars. That it's probably too much to ask that we break the American dependence on the automobile overnight. My guess is that's where we'll be, at least for a little while, as we're in this transition towards a more interesting and hopefully more densified world that we're building out. One of the great ironies of the moment is that we have this extraordinary problem. Climate change is the biggest crisis humans have ever had. And we have this set of at least partial solutions that come with renewable energy. And yet we're not really making anything like full use of them. And that is the truly, if we had no way around the crises we were in, that'd be one thing. But it is maddening to have those solutions and not use them. One of the points I make in the book is that Jimmy Carter, when he was running for president, pledged that he, in 1980 and in his budget, set aside money to assure that America would go to 20% solar energy by the year 2000. And there's no technological reason we couldn't have done that had we applied ourselves as he imagined. It's not like there's been some impossible technological breakthrough that wouldn't have happened. All it would have taken was that kind of focus. But of course, we went in exactly the opposite direction, and we're still going there. Despite the fact that this is now the cheapest energy on Earth, the US Congress is unable to pass Biden's climate legislation. 50 Republican senators and one Democrat, your neighbor from West Virginia, Mr. Manchin, have combined to block any change here. Joe Manchin took more money from the fossil fuel industry than anybody else in Washington, which is a hard contest to win, but he won it. And the return on investment for that those campaign donations has been completely staggering. I mean, they've been able to block the expenditure of the funds that would really unlock a lot of the kind of changes that we need. That's why we have to keep organizing. At some level, it's highly irrational that we have to keep organizing. To put it frankly, I'm tired of having to go to jail over and over and over again to accomplish, you know, just the most basic things that every scientist has been telling us we should be doing for decades now. But clearly, that's part of what it takes. And when we do organize, we can win real victories. We've stopped huge pipelines. We've divested trillions of dollars from the fossil fuel industry. But we're not there yet, and it's going to take another round of that kind of organizing, and older people are going to have to be a big part of that if it's going to be successful. It's not just demographically possible to do it entirely with college kids. It's going to have to be the rest of us, too, that pitch in here. Thank you very much for your work and for that.
Yeah, Bill, I have a bum leg here, so I'm not going to stand up. But but I also wanted to, thank you for your work. I've, followed your career with great interest and enthusiasm. I study economics. You know, I majored in it in college, and I'm particularly interested these days in money systems. And studying, cryptocurrency, you can, talk about Web 3.0, but our current economic system, just by its design, forces bigness. I live in a suburb outside of Philly here, and I had this wonderful little bank, that it was 100 years old, and just by the banking regulations, they were forced to merge with another bank, and now it's just not the same. Yep. So I'm wondering, because it seems to me like there is something going on with Bitcoin, and it's incredibly intricate and almost magical design, and I'm wondering if you've given any thought to kind of that as a potential technological innovation that can change things, because it sure seems to me that the economic system is broken, as clearly our political system is also.
So you know more about Bitcoin than I do. Happily, in our household, my wife writes about cryptocurrency a good deal for the New Yorker, so I sort of rely on her. And you're more confident in its possibilities than I am, I think. There are a couple of things. I mean, as you know, at least at the moment, Bitcoin is an extraordinary energy suck of its own. And the mining, as it's called, of new Bitcoin is now using more energy than entire Scandinavian countries in the course of a year. I was just up helping some friends in upstate New York because they're reopening old coal-fired power plants that we'd managed to get closed down solely to power computers to mine more Bitcoin. But let's assume you could figure out some way around that problem. The thing that strikes me about it is that its main appeal for at least an awful lot of its backers and the people who founded it seems to be that it's a way to further individualize the world, to further reduce the power of our ability to work together. I mean, it's a way to get around governments and to say that we don't want government control over supply of money and things. And truthfully, I think that getting around government, getting around democracy, getting around our ability to work together to do things has been at the root of the problem that we've stumbled into. So one of the things where I'm pleased about with this bank campaigning that we're doing is precisely that we're trying to drive people in the direction of local credit unions, small banks, emerging banks on the web that are doing, or banks that have made real and devoted efforts to clean up their act. On the East Coast, Amalgamated Bank, the big labor bank. On the West Coast, Beneficial State Bank, so on. But you're very right to be concerned about the bigness of all of this. The numbers are really astonishing. I just did a piece for The New Yorker about a new study that tried to put for the first time numbers on how much carbon cash in that system produces. And it's staggering. They looked at the holdings of these big tech companies, all of which have pledged to go net zero. Well, when you count the effects of their cash, because it gets lent out by banks to build pipelines and things, Google's carbon emissions go up 111%. Facebook's likewise, Microsoft's 170%. Netflix produces more carbon from its cash than all the streaming of all its shows all the time. Amazon, more carbon from its cash than every warehouse and delivery van that it owns. And the same numbers really apply to all of us too. If you have $125,000 in savings in the kind of mainstream banking system in this country, it's producing more carbon than the average American produces with all the things they do in the course of a year. All the driving, flying, heating, cooking, cooling, whatever. That's why we're pulling everybody together to cut up their credit cards at year's end if these banks haven't begun to shift. But it's why we're very hopeful that we can get those big tech companies on board because it's one thing for me to go get arrested in the lobby of the Chase Bank. That was helpful, and you know the drive that we kicked off 2 years ago doing that was enough at least to get them to adopt some new policies. But if we could get Tim Cook from Apple in there saying to Jamie Dimon of Chase, you know what, bro, you got to choose between my business and Exxon's business because we can't do the things we've promised to do as long as you're banking with you, that would be a huge help. There's only two levers in this game, climate game, big enough to pull that really matter at this point. One of them is labeled politics. We've got it pulled almost all the way to the floor. It's not doing much yet, thanks to people like Manchin. We're getting much closer. We've got to keep working it. If by some miracle we had a great election in November, then things could shift, you know. But the other lever is marked money or finance, and we've got to pull it too, in large part because those big banks, Wall Street's actually more of a global power center than Washington at this point. And if we could get them to make commitments, if Chase said tomorrow we're no longer lending for fossil fuel expansion, well, every stock market in the world would reflect that new reality inside of 10 minutes. So there's good work to be done, I think, even within the existing confines of the financial system. Thanks.
I agree with you there. I have to say, you know, because it seems to me that the existing system is corrupt and it needs to be replaced.
We may see some shift like that take place. In the meantime, we've got this system where we've got right now, so we better push it hard to see what change we can get. The thing to remember about climate change is that the window that we're talking about here is by this point very short. They've told us the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that if we haven't cut emissions in half by 2030, our chance of meeting the climate targets we set in Paris is essentially nil. So we're not used to timed tests, and we're used to political systems that, if they move at all, move with great slowness. We've got to figure out how to goose that system fast and in lots of ways. Well, an extraordinary pleasure to be with you guys. Thank you for braving the thunder to come here. Thank you very much for being here. And if you are of the right vintage, go check out thirdact.org. And even if you're close, I mean, God willing, you're moving in our direction, you know, so no reason not to check it out. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.